When I was 5 years old, I found a fence outside our little bungalow that was fun to climb. The only problem was the woven steel threads had dangerously sharp ends at the top. My father came outside, saw me climbing, and told me to stop because I might get hurt. After he went back inside, I climbed up again, of course. And that time, I caught the inside of my arm on one of the sharp ends. It gouged a deep cut in my arm. I went inside to my dad, sheepish and crying. He dressed and bandaged the wound and never said, "I told you so." I still have the scar, which, whenever I catch sight of it, reminds me of my father's caring. When I was 6, I proudly showed my father the small cardboard cap off the top of a milk bottle, remember those, that I was holding tightly. The cap contained a bunch of cute ladybugs that I had been collecting for the past hour. My father gently said, "Open your hand." And I was stunned and dismayed to see that I had smothered all the ladybugs. It was a lesson in not holding on too tightly, which I never forgot. At age 7, I had lost a toy behind the thick bushes outside our apartment. I was afraid to go in and retrieve it. There might be spiders back there or something equally creepy. But my dad wouldn't go in for me. He said, "I'll watch you. You'll be okay. Just go in carefully." When I emerged from behind the bushes triumphant, toy in hand, my father said, "We'll make a woodsman of you yet." Since then, though I remained a city girl, I began to think of wooded areas as wonderful places. When I was 8, my father read in the newspaper that a bright comet would be visible that night. He took me out to the deserted street at the end of our apartment complex, and we looked for the comet. We saw it, even through the smoggy haze of New York City, we managed to catch a glimpse. A glimpse of this comet with its bright tail streaming, seemingly balanced on the edge of an immense gas storage tank. How romantic. But seeing this comet kindled in me a lifelong love of astronomy. At the age of 9, I came home from Catholic catechism class full of the fearsome ideas a priest had taught us and told my father what I had learned. My father said quietly, "Just remember that priests are only men. They're not God, and they're not always right about everything." From this simple reminder, I took his implicit permission to think more for myself. And years later, I found a religious tradition, Unitarian Universalism, which encourages us to question traditional religious teachings and to rely on our own inner lights. I eventually turned this interest into my life's work. When I was 10, as Christmas approached, I told my dad that I wanted a telescope or a microscope. He asked me which I wanted most, and I said I couldn't decide. On Christmas morning, to my surprise and delight, both gifts appeared under the tree. At the time, I couldn't appreciate the sacrifice that had been made that lean year so that I could have both gifts. When I was 16 and building my own telescope in science projects class, it was my father, a machinist, who supplied a mount for it, fashioning it out of metal scraps during his breaks at work. Around that time, he had a serious injury at work. Many years later, my sister disclosed that it was when he was making that telescope mount for me that he injured himself and nearly lost a finger, something he didn't want me to know, fearing that I'd feel guilty. Today, we honor those who acted as fathers to us. Although my dad died 27 years ago, he is still with me in these memories I have shared and in so many others. I think of him often and always on Father's Day. I have much to be grateful for. Perhaps some of you also use this holiday to remember the gifts and lessons you received from the one or ones who filled a fathering role for you. The exact origin of Father's Day is lost in obscurity. Various dates and places have been suggested as the first Father's Day, clustering around the early part of the last century. But it seems likely that it was inspired by the earlier institution of Mother's Day. In Spokane, Washington, oh, this is a spider. Wow. See, I'm not afraid of them anymore. That's great. Yes. He sent it. That's great. We'll let it do its thing here. In Spokane, Washington, in 1909, a woman by the name of Sonora Smart Dodd thought of setting aside a day for fathers while listening to a Mother's Day sermon. She did it to honor her own father, a veteran of the Civil War, who raised 6 children alone after his wife died in childbirth. Sonora Dodd approached her minister about having a church service dedicated to fathers on June 5th, her own father's birthday. It's right on the microphone now. Got some comments? So she dedicated that day to fathers on her own father's birthday, which was June 5th. But the minister wanted more time to prepare for this, and so he set the special service for June 19th, 2 weeks later. The next year, Sonora Dodd enlisted the support of the Ministerial Association and the YMCA in Spokane, and from then on, the state of Washington celebrated the third Sunday in June as Father's Day. So, soon after this and some other efforts to honor fathers with a special day, states and organizations began lobbying Congress to declare an annual Father's Day. In 1916, President Woodrow Wilson approved the idea. And finally, in 1924, President Calvin Coolidge made it a national event to be celebrated henceforward on the third Sunday in June. Father's Day was created, the Declaration said, to establish more intimate relations between fathers and their children and to impress upon fathers the full measure of their obligations. As the wording of the Declaration indicates, back then, the more traditional image of father as breadwinner and absentee parent prevailed. And Father's Day was established not just to thank fathers, but to encourage them to be more involved in their children's lives. Compared to Mother's Day, Father's Day may seem like a minor holiday, an afterthought. 39 years ago, I made this point in passing during a sermon back in Davis, and a local newspaper reporter in the congregation asked me to elaborate on it in an opinion article for the local newspaper. In that article, I pointed out that the rows of Father's Day cards in stores take up far less space than the rows of Mother's Day cards, and that while kids make lacy greeting cards and write poems in school for their mothers as Mother's Day approaches, school is out by Father's Day, and little fuss is made over Father's holiday. This, I said, is because the parental role of women is more highly valued than that of men. And in fact, the role of mother is thought to be the single most important role for women, while the role of father has traditionally been thought of as just one of many important roles for men. I concluded that article with these words. The slow progress toward a fairer distribution of roles and responsibilities between men and women will continue, perhaps toward the year when Father's Day is as great a celebration as Mother's Day, or even toward the time when Parents' Day outshines them both. Well, we still don't have a gender-free Parents' Day, but a lot has changed with regard to sex roles since those days, obviously. There are still more Mother's Day cards than Father's Day ones on the shelves. But Father's Day boasts the highest number, get this, the highest number of collect calls placed. Collect calls, mind you. Which only goes to show that the traditional role of father as provider persists, even long after the kids have left home. Nevertheless, we have witnessed a cultural change in this country in the last three decades. Fathers these days are often present in the room at the birth of their children, rather than isolated in a waiting room waiting to pass out cigars. Fathers tend to take much more of an active role in raising children, including doing all of the chores, making the best spaghetti. And women, while still mothering, have entered the workforce and now comprise around 50% of it. So the once very separate roles are being shared much more evenly, out of choice in some cases, out of necessity in others. Many men nowadays say that of all the roles they fill in their lives, the role of father is the most important. Even many men who are now older or are now grandfathers, looking back on their lives, see their fathering as the most important single thing they have done. I can't think of anything significant about parenting that a mother can do which a father cannot, or vice versa, except for the obvious bearing and suckling of the child. Fathers can be every bit as caring and nurturing as mothers, and many are discovering the joys of that role. And mothers can be strong disciplinarians when needed, and who says mom can't throw around a baseball or take her son or daughter fishing? These activities depend on the individual's abilities and interests, not upon the parent's gender. It's important, I believe, for children to have people of both genders in many roles guiding them throughout their growing years. Parents, teachers, mentors. But as for the parenting role, who does what, we are discovering, can be much more flexible than previous ages assumed. And it need not be defined by gender. And I'm always touched when a child of same-sex couples says, my two daddies and my two mommies. So until there is a Parents' Day, if there ever is a Parents' Day, we can celebrate all of the roles of fathers and all of the roles of mothers on their increasingly equal separate holidays. I, for one, always enjoyed having a special day to acknowledge all that my father has done for me. Although now that he has gone, the holiday has turned somewhat bittersweet. I want to say to all of you today who have fathered children or who have nurtured and cared for children not your own, you fathers, stepfathers, grandfathers, uncles, school teachers, happy Father's Day. We are indeed grateful. Oh, it's coming down. It's landed on my sermon. Or the next installment, I'll put it on the, well, there it is. Safely in a crevice on the pulpit. I want to say congratulations to all of you. You have called your sixth settled minister. And in calling a minister of color, you have done what the Unitarian Universalist Association's president, Peter Morales, has called a bold new thing. Now, I know that some of you did not have the fact that the Reverend Maria Cristina Bergoa, Vlasidis Bergoa, is a minister of color, on your radar or foremost in your mind when she was candidating here in May. But she is a minister of color, and that is an important part of her self-identity, as she herself has said to you. The fact is, over the years, Unitarian Universalists have taken several bold new steps that have increased the diversity of our once almost entirely white, straight, male ministry. For instance, women in our pulpits were very rare when I entered ministry back in 1974. So rare that we often made it into newspapers as the first woman parish minister in a given town. That happened to me in several places, and I was even chased around by TV and radio programs because it was news. Now, over half of our pulpits are filled by women. I never, ever really thought I would see that kind of increase in my lifetime. And back in 1980, this congregation did another bold new thing for the time and called an out gay minister, the Reverend Mark Bellatini, as your fourth settled minister. Now, many, many of our pulpits are filled by gay, lesbian, and bisexual ministers, although transgender ministers are still rare. Historically, there have been hurdles that presented themselves for both minister and congregation when each of these categories of diversity was added to our ministry. When I was one of a half dozen or so women in Unitarian Universalist pulpits, I remember some special challenges. For example, when I came up to the front of a church wearing a robe for a wedding and stood there, people thought I was about to sing or something. A woman officiating a wedding was almost unheard of. There were always remarks from wedding guests afterward that I was the first such creature they had ever seen. And we early women in ministry discovered that some people expected us to be single-issue ministers, always speaking about feminism in some way, or about women breaking professional barriers, or about the great mother goddess. The fact is, in my early ministry, I did very little of this. But even if I only took care to say humankind instead of mankind in some sermon that had nothing to do with women's issues, I would often hear later via the grapevine, that people felt I focused too much on feminism. In the Beyond Categorical Thinking workshop that this congregation engaged in with a UUA consultant last fall, one of the case studies that some of you worked on in a small group was about this very thing, a single-issue minister, as it applies to ministers of color. That is, people assuming that because there is a minister of color, that minister will always be talking about race issues, or the fear that people harbor that a minister of color will come with an agenda that will result in members feeling guilt and shame about race issues. That is so similar to what I experienced as an early woman. And ministers of color report this very phenomenon. There are, I am sure, many other challenges that ministers of color encounter in serving mostly white congregations, and many subtle and not so subtle ways in which fears, inherent biases, and prejudices among the congregation will rear up. Boy, are they noisy. Your challenge as a congregation and as individual members is to become more aware of those biases, to work with your minister in an atmosphere of mutual trust and honesty, to examine and overcome obstacles based on race, and to strive to become essentially more multiculturally savvy. These are challenges I firmly believe you are up to. And you already have a committee, the Anti-Racism Multicultural Alliance, that's been working on multiculturalism here for some time. So far, ministers of color in our pulpits are still quite rare, around 5%. And it is known that their tenures are significantly shorter than those of white ministers. This is very possibly, at least in part, because we haven't yet figured out how to be as welcoming to this diverse group of ministers as we would like to be. In recent years, more people of color have gone into seminaries that educate our ministers. So hopefully there will eventually be an increase of ministers of color among us. Working with your new minister, this church can be on the cutting edge of the move toward becoming more diverse and more multiculturally competent and more of a force against oppression based on race. Perhaps someday we will have racial diversity both in our pulpits and our pews, a diversity that will reflect the increasing diversity of the American population. In the words of UUA President Peter Morales, speaking about diversity in ministry, "Today it is no big deal to call a woman. It isn't even noteworthy. In many congregations, it is no big deal to call a gay or lesbian minister. I pray the day is coming soon when we can say that it is no big deal for a congregation to call a minister who is a person of color." This is an exciting time for all of you members of this community, and I wish you well on your coming adventure.